Hello.
My name is Isaac Brickman, and welcome to Office Hours. Each episode, I will talk to a professor about a topic that is relevant to you. On each show, the guest will have a different perspective on the topic. The goal is twofold. First, I want to make academia more accessible, applicable, and exciting to everyone, including non-academic audiences. I also want to help dissolve the boundaries between disciplines by taking a more holistic approach to learning. Dr. Christina Steiner is a lifespan developmental psychologist who teaches at Denison University. She runs a research program which focuses on autobiographical memory and is especially interested in investigating the directive function of personal and shared memories across age groups and cultures, and the relationship between life story narratives and various outcomes such as well-being. Welcome to the show, Christina. How are you doing?
I'm doing really good. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good. I want to get started with the topic your research is really focused on, which is autobiographical memory.
Mm-hmm.
I think the simplest way to sort of dissect this topic is just sort of asking you what it is. What is autobiographical memory?
Sure. So I think it's sort of interesting to define it because we're so embedded within it, right? So it's something that we all experience. We experience it all the time. But basically, it's just recollections of your personal experience. And I think what's interesting about this is that in order to remember your personal experiences, we actually have to have a couple of things happening. So one, you have to have a sense of self, right? So if you don't have a sense of self, there's no way to track that self throughout time. So that's something that's sort of interesting if we're trying to think about why, for example, very young children don't usually have autobiographical memories, memories of personal experience. It's probably because they don't yet have a sense of self. So really what we're doing with autobiographical memory is tracking the self through time. And another thing that's pretty interesting about it is that we sort of go into a different state of consciousness when we are doing that remembering of the past. So for example, we can usually tell the difference between when we're actually experiencing something, let's say right now, and the experience of sort of mental time travel that we do when we remember the past. So there's sort of a different kind of conscious experience of it. So for example, if we like close our eyes and remember our 16th birthday, for example, we'll know that we've gone into a different type of state than if we're currently experiencing something. So you have to have the sense of self through time. And then the other thing that's sort of important for autobiographical memory is this different state of consciousness that we go into. And it's actually the same kind of state that you go into when you imagine the future. So we can do it when we're recalling the past, but if we also say, I want to kind of imagine what's going to happen to me next week, it's that same type of mental time travel that we do. So with autobiographical memory, we're obviously recalling past experiences, but it's also the exact same thing that we do when we imagine the future.
So speaking of, the future, I think it's interesting because when people think about just memory as a concept, they usually think about the past, but memory obviously isn't limited to the past. What are some of the ways our memories affect our present selves and our future selves?
Yeah, that's a great question. So this is actually a lot of what my research is based on. What you're sort of asking is what's the function of memory? Like, why do we have this system where we can mentally travel back into the past or imagine things into the future or sort of use it to influence what we're experiencing right now. So there's three main functions. So I think the most obvious one and maybe the one that's going to be the most relevant for today is that memories make up our sense of self. So if you imagine How do you know what you like? How do you know the kind of person that you are? A lot of that information comes from past experiences. I know that I like coffee because I've had it before, and here are all of these experiences that tell me that I like that. How do I know that I'm someone who's extroverted or introverted? It's because I've had these past experiences and they tell me this is who I am and this is how I think and how I feel. And you can see that disruption of the self in a lot of ways, but I think maybe the most obvious one perhaps is in Alzheimer's disease, where you can really see what happens to the sense of self when those memories are lost or they're not able to be accessed anymore. So definitely autobiographical memory is really important because it makes up our sense of self. But we also use it a lot to help us make decisions. So especially when you don't have a script for how to act, maybe you're in a new situation, doing a podcast for the first time, or let's say you're just going to a restaurant that you've never been to before. Here, autobiographical memory is also going to be really helpful because you can rely on past experiences to say, I think I should act this way, and I think it would be good to behave like this. We can also use memories to make sure that we don't make the same mistakes that we made in the past. And so you'll see people use autobiographical memory like, whoo, I remember I missed the bus because I didn't check the schedule on the weekends, and I'm never going to do that again. And so it helps inform the kind of decisions that we make. It helps us plan. It helps us remember what our goals are so we know how to act in the future. And then I think maybe people don't think about this one either, but it's also how we bond with other people. If you're thinking like, how do I make friends or what do I do on a first date? Usually it's some kind of sharing of personal information, personal experiences. And the way that we sort of make and maintain social bonds is by sharing the experiences that we've had in the past and then reminiscing with people. Like, oh, do you remember when we did that? That was really great. Now I feel close to you and you feel close to me. And so it helps us make social bonds and also maintain them across time.
It seems like memory just really affects sort of like everything is the foundation to sort of survival and like in a more abstract way society. So I think that's very interesting how just important memory is, but I haven't really thought of it that way. So that's really cool. Why are the ways we remember the past chapters we organize our lives into, such as child or married life, more important to like our own identity, our own sense of self, than how we remember a specific event, like let's say a birthday party?
Absolutely. So here we're thinking about the organization of autobiographical memory and the way it's sort of conceptualized is as a hierarchy, or you can think of it sort of like a nesting doll, where we have specific episodes happen one time, might just be a couple minutes long in terms of the memory, maybe sort of 24 hours at the max. And that's sort of the most detailed, most specific level of memory. Then we can go up and we can think about categories of events where it's something that you've experienced a lot and you've experienced it so many times that you sort of lose track of a specific example of it. That might be like the middle level. And then we can go further up and think about life chapters. These are going to be really long, extended periods of time. Like you said, maybe childhood, maybe my marriage, maybe my work life. And so you can see that they're sort of organized differently, where that specific episode, one time, couple minutes, up to 24 hours, whereas life story chapters are going to be really extended periods of time. So if we're thinking about what remembering one versus the other might be like, there are specific episodes that are really important to us, to our understanding. So you can think, for example, maybe there's a day in childhood where you broke your arm, or maybe we can think about your wedding day. These are going to be really specific, and also very important to the sense of self. So I wouldn't say kind of unilaterally that there are no specific memories that are important to the self. But when we think about chapters, you have to do a lot of reasoning about them. And so when we think about life story chapters, usually people, give them themes, right? So this is my childhood, and my childhood was like this. And they sort of make a story about it. And they give it causality too. I experienced this, and this led to this, and this is why I am the way that I am. So when you think about those life story chapters, they have themes, they have causality, they have coherence, and there's just a lot more meaning making that people tend to do for these extended time periods than they do for specific episodes in general. But like I said, there are some specific episodes that are so important that people do the exact same thing. Like this was a self-defining or life-changing event. But for the most part, we sort of save that reasoning and that meaning making for those extended time periods. And we use those chapters to tell our life stories. And so again, when we're trying to bond with people, we can say, this is my childhood. My childhood was like this. It has this theme. It led to these events. And that explains who I am and my sense of self. So I think that's why you can have specific episodes that are really important, but in general, life story chapters are going to be more powerful for that sense of self.
I can kind of intuitively see how one organizing their sense of self broadly into these life story chapters can be problematic, because obviously the world is really complicated, and then when you try to like simplify the world into this trauma was caused by, or this trauma means that I am, or this chapter means that I am, it can sort of lead to some sort of crisis of self. I could definitely see how that works on like sort of an abstract level. And speaking of I guess this sort of like mental problems that come with memory, it seems that people with PTSD, anxiety, and depression are especially likely to have a preponderance of negative autobiographical memories relative to those without these disorders, at least based on what I read. So, why is autobiographical memory associated with these disorders in particular?
Yeah, absolutely. So that I think is going to take us back to that function question, right? Where one of the functions of autobiographical memory is to make up the self. And when we start thinking about mental health issues and things like PTSD or depression or anxiety, what you're seeing is a disruption of the self, and the way that the person thinks of the self. So you're exactly right that what we tend to see in these disorders is a bias towards negative memories. Which is interesting because in people who've never experienced depression or social anxiety, you see the exact opposite. In general, people tend to have a positivity bias, right? So if right now I said, think of five memories from your life. If you're not depressed and you don't have anxiety, you're likely to give me positive memories from your life. And what we see is that when you do the same kind of question with people who have depression, they're way more likely to give you negative memories. Same thing with anxiety. Same thing with PTSD. So I think sort of what we're seeing is a side effect of a disruption in the way that people think about the self, right? If you think about the self negatively, when you're asked to generate memories, you kind of automatically go right to those negative experiences. And unfortunately, what that does, you can see it's sort of cyclical. If it's easy for you to access negative memories, then what you're doing is reinforcing this idea of like, I'm worthless and I've always been worthless. All I can think of are these negative experiences and these negative memories. Here's another example of how negative things are for me. It's always been like that. It will always be like that. And you can see that when you're sort of selectively recalling negative memories, it feeds into that, kind of disordered way of thinking about the self.
Yeah, I could definitely see that, how that is a destructive cycle for sure. And I think one would say the way to break that cycle is to try to start recalling more positive autobiographical memories. So, especially when it comes to people with mental illness, what should we focus on when trying to recall positive autobiographical memories to sort of elicit the most benefit?
Yeah, so I would say for someone who doesn't have mental health issues, this is sort of what we're automatically doing anyway. You can see how it's sort of self-destructive to the self to focus on the negative experiences. So I think what we see is people who can recall positive memories tend to benefit from that. So you can get a little bit of boost in mood from recalling positive memories. You get a little bit of boost in your self-esteem when you recall positive memories. So I don't actually think there's a wrong way to think about positive memories. It might just be a sort of more conscious focus on, if I select a positive memory to focus on and I do that intentionally, that will probably lift my mood a little bit, make me feel a little bit better. Although the length of time that it does that is pretty brief, right? So it's a sort of mild intervention. I think kind of more important than that is for anyone who is suffering from depression or anxiety is sort of getting to the root of the problem for why the views of the self are so negative and why the patterns of thinking are constantly leading back to negative memories. So I think an intervention might be to force people, this is not something that you do naturally, and this is not a way of thinking that you tend to use, but basically, for every time that you think about a negative memory, let's force you to also think about a positive one. So we sort of naturally land on these negative experiences. What if we spend some time and instead think about the good things that have happened or the good things that might happen in the future? Because a lot of therapy is about sort of disrupting those pathways of thinking that have formed that are really negative and sort of reframing to focus not on only the negative or the bad things that can happen, but also the good things.
Yeah, that definitely makes sense. And I think people might also have this reaction if they have like a mental illness that, oh, okay, so the way to clear this up would be to avoid thinking about negative memories at all. But I mean, I could see at least, I think a lot of people might be able to see that that's not necessarily the most, constructive way to deal with one's mental health.
Yeah.
So I think you definitely have to contend with those negative autobiographical memories too. How should one deal with those in a way that's constructive to the self and doesn't lead to that self-destructive cycle we were talking about?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you're exactly right that trying to avoid negative memories and negative experiences is counterproductive. We have something called the ironic process of mental control, which is a fancy way to say basically the harder you try to not think about something, the more likely it is to come to mind. So the more you try to suppress a thought, actually the more active it is. So kind of counterintuitively, we want to do the exact opposite of suppression, which is sort of allow the memory to exist. And part of what happens in therapy is that you sort of are able to talk about that experience in a way that makes it less intense or less scary, and basically just exposure to the experience enough times lessens the stress associated with it. And so I think exposure to the negative memories in a sort of controlled setting is really good. What we want to avoid, though, is something called rumination, where you sort of take away the control of that situation and maybe the benefit of the therapist helping you work through it. With rumination, you just think about the negative thing over and over and over and over again. And that, without sort of meaning making or trying to make sense of it, that rumination is really bad for functioning. So I would say, in terms of negative memories, the thing to avoid would be rumination, where we're dwelling and we're thinking over and over and over about the negative experience without any of that kind of work that happens, where you try to make sense of it, sort of take the sting or pain of the memory out of it and move forward. And I think there's more to your question I've sort of forgotten. So what, come back, tell me again, what this question is focused on.
Basically, how I think you basically answered the question. I think what we're trying to say, or what you're trying to say, is that
you need to really take an active role in remembering negative events in order to prevent it from leading to a destructive cycle where you just ruminate on the memories, and that memory makes you think about more bad memories, which makes you more depressed, anxious, et cetera, et cetera.
Absolutely.
So,
And also that it's a good sort of to, so I guess what's interesting about the negative memories in people with mental health issues is that the even in neutral events or sort of ambiguous events, people with mental health issues will tend to focus on the negative aspects of it. So it's not only that with depression, you're faster at pulling negative memories and it's easier to access negative memories. It's that the memories that you form from the start are sort of negative in tone. And so another part of it would be when kind of experiencing events to consciously focus on positive aspects of it. And that is, again, that sort of reframing that happens where sort of my natural way of thinking about this is that it's bad and it's negative. And here's another example of this negative thing that's happening. And we have to sort of stop and reframe and say, okay, that's sort of my first experience of this situation. Now I'm going to consciously say, but this was nice and this was positive. Even if it's only a very small aspect of the situation, the more that we sort of bring in the positive, the easier it is to start recalling the positive aspects. Whereas if when the memory is forming in the first place, it's only negative and you're only focusing on the bad, then it becomes basically impossible to pull any positive meaning from it because you never thought about the situation that way in the first place. So I think sort of combining those two ideas that one, we would want to spend more time thinking about positive memories. But that might be hard if all of the memories that you've formed are sort of negatively toned. So sort of reframing the way that we think about the situations that we're in to focus more on the positive, in a kind of conscious way.
do you think people with mental illnesses who are remembering these negative events, do you find them to prescribe more of an abstract meaning onto it as it relates to the self? For example, I had an embarrassing moment in class. This shows that I'm like not, I'm like not a socially acceptable person. People aren't going to like me, versus somebody who doesn't have those mental illnesses recalling that same sort of event, and they just think to themselves, oh, this isn't indicative of my identity. This isn't who I am. This is just an event that happened, and it doesn't define myself.
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the kind of hallmarks of mental illness is a global way of thinking about the negative things. So just exactly this is not an example that I can sort of brush off. This is an example of who I am as a person. And so I've always been anxious and awkward. Here's another example. I always will be this way. So yeah, sort of it goes into this definition of self, which is deeply negative. And yeah, I think it's instead of just being a one-off that we can ignore, it adds more fuel to the fire of sort of the disruptive ways of thinking about the self.
And tell me about your research specifically and how it relates to what we've been talking about.
Yeah, so I'll have to say right away, I'm not a clinician. I'm, like I said, I think at the start, I'm interested in the functions. So, sort of asking, why do we have autobiographical memory and when do we use it? Sort of mostly I've focused on the directive function, which is this idea of using memories to direct future behaviors and help us plan and identify goals. So that's something that I've been interested in for a long time. I've also been interested in looking at how specific memories versus chapters relate to measures of well-being, like self-esteem, for example, or feelings of continuity, and sort of looking at how different ways of thinking about memories from the specific level to the chapter level, how does that influence your thinking about the self, your self-esteem, or your feelings of coherence. And then I've also spent a lot of time looking at something called vicarious memories. This is not actually autobiographical memory. It's memories of other people, other people's lives, sort of the stories that our friends tell us or the stories that our parents tell us, and looking at the functions of those memories, because they're sort of an interesting category. They're not actually experienced by the person, they're not autobiographical, and yet it seems like they serve those same kind of functions. So you can tell me a story about an awkward experience you had as a student, and I don't actually have to experience that to plan for the future or to update my idea about myself or to help us bond. So I think my research sort of has connections to mental health questions. And people definitely sort of take ideas from my research and apply it in other situations that have to do with mental health. But I'm much more interested, sort of in the broad population. What are the functions of memories? How is memory organized? And less focused on the specific applications, although there are many, that exist.
And what future research do you think needs to be done to get a clearer picture of how autobiographical memory relates to the self?
I mean, I think just continuing doing what people are doing, I think we have a very clear idea that it is necessary for the self. You get that from studies of people with brain damage, where when the autobiographical memory system is damaged, you get big disruptions to the self. So I think we're sort of well aware of that connection, but I do think people need to continue doing the research with different types of disorders, so depression, anxiety, PTSD, because we know a lot about people in general, but I think the research about life story chapters and depression, or life story chapters and suicidality, that research just is coming out right now in the past, 5, 10 years. So I think sort of continuing to look at specific populations, specific groups, seeing how these patterns of the relation of memory and the self are the same, or maybe they're different in different populations. I also think psychology in general has a pretty Western focus. So I think all of these ideas are really important to explore outside of the US, outside of a sort of individualistic culture perspective. So just sort of broadening what we know, because I actually think these ideas about the self should probably vary quite a bit by culture, especially if the culture has a different idea about what the self is and what the self's relation to that culture is. Yeah, so that would be my suggestions for sort of future research.
It sounds great. I think it makes sense that every culture has like a significantly different viewpoint of the self, because the self kind of like informs everything in a way.
Yeah, the culture makes the self, and the self makes the culture, and they're this sort of cyclical, bidirectional thing that's happening.
Yeah, of course. Let's get to the another edition of the Google the Professor quiz. My first question for you is, what's your favorite part about teaching at Denison?
Okay, so Denison is a small liberal arts college, so we have very small class sizes. So I love that because you get to know students really well. And I think my favorite thing about teaching to a small group of students is that you know them really well. You can make examples that are sort of tailored exactly to them. But I also just love telling people about things that they don't know that are really cool. So I don't know that that's specific to Denison, but it's nice when you have such a small group of students and I can share, like, oh, did you know that with depression, people are really likely to get negative chapters? And they're like, oh, that's so cool. So I love the sharing of knowledge and being able to do it in a small group where you can really get to know people and make examples that are important to them. And then they get to sort of take the ideas and apply it to situations that are important to them.
Yeah, I was once able to take a class at Amherst College, which is much smaller than the school I went to, which was UMass, and that class only had I think like six people in it, and it was 1.5 hours, and we had to read the Republic, and you like definitely had to do the readings. You could not skip out of the readings in that class because it was all sort of Socratic method, pulling up quotes from the books. We also had to read like all these books by Rousseau, but it was a lot of fun. I got to know the students in a way that I didn't in all my other classes at UMass, which was a lot of like, I would say 25 to like 200 kids. So getting that six person class was so it was a very different experience, and I definitely I'm glad I took it. Can you tell me about your adult development and aging class?
Sure, absolutely. So like yeah, I m my research focuses in memory. I'm trained as a developmental psychologist, so I do lifespan development. So one class that I teach is adult development and aging. And I think probably this is one of my favorite classes to teach, but essentially we look at the same kind of concepts that you would see in an intro psych class, just specifically focused on aging, right? So from about age 60 on through the rest of the lifespan, what happens to the brain as we age? What happens to thinking as we age? What happens to our social relationships as we age? What happens to our physical health as we age, right? So basically, all of the things that you would cover in intro, now just focused on older adults. And I love that class because, like I said before, I like telling people things that they don't know. And what I found is that college students know absolutely nothing about older adults. So every day is just like, here's something I know you don't know. And we're going to get really excited about, I think, how resilient older adults are. So there's this sort of doom and gloom idea about aging. And I think instead it's just like the human brain and the human body are so resilient in ways that are amazing. It's really fun to share that. And maybe sort of adjust some stereotypes that people have about aging so they leave the class a little bit more informed about things. You know, if we're lucky, everybody ages. And so it's important, I think, to also know the things that will happen to you.
Yeah, I think a lot definitely happens during aging, and as a just graduate of college, I definitely don't know a lot about it myself. I have a family member who's in his 90s, and he actually is still like very active. He still plays tennis, and I just think like, wow, it's really interesting how some people age in a very sort of subtle way, and other people age in a very sort of downhill way, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. There's huge individual differences. That's one of the main themes of the class, is that any sort of thing that we talk about, there have to be caveats because it will apply to some people and not to others, because just the experience of aging is so different for people. Absolutely.
And final question, what did you get a PhD in from the University of New Hampshire?
Yeah, so I'm a developmental psychologist. So my PhD is in development, my master's is in cognition, and my dissertation was on the creation of life stories in 10, 12, and 14-year-olds. So sort of asking about when does the ability to make life story chapters sort of come online? When does that start to be a thing that people can do? So I interviewed 10-year-olds, 12-year-olds, and 14-year-olds and have had them tell me their life stories, which was super fun to have a 10-year-old tell you their life story, break it up into chapters. The 14-year-olds are much better at telling a life story than the 10-year-olds are. So we see that there's sort of this development of the ability to do it and have it make sense and have it be in chronological order and have it have themes or any sort of coherence at all. That's something that develops over time. So that was my dissertation.
Well, that's a very cool dissertation. Well, thanks for coming on the show, Christina. I really appreciate the time, and I'm glad we were able to have this conversation.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.